Hello, my name is Helena. I'm a London Blue Badge guide, a City of London guide, and London Walks guide. And I guided for London Walks from 1997 until 2014, when I stopped guiding on a full-time professional basis. I now live in Truro, Cornwall, and from my ground floor apartment window, I have the most glorious view of Truro Cathedral, where I hope to be guiding in the not-too-distant future. I'd just been accepted to join the team of volunteer guides at the cathedral when lockdown occurred. And while the cathedral has reopened to the public, not as yet for guided tours. So in the meantime, I'm about to start the research process to prepare notes for my guided tour so that when the cathedral is able to offer that service again, I'll be all ready to go. And the whole process of preparing notes for a tour has brought back to me such happy memories of when I guided for London Walks, and particularly of the National Gallery walk. Now, the National Gallery has reopened to the public under restricted terms, so you have to pre-book and follow one of three set routes. But when London Walks is able to offer the National Gallery walk again, I do urge you to go if you've not yet been, or why not go again? Over the course of 2 hours, you'll be introduced to some of the finest works of Western European art from the middle of the 13th century to the early 20th century by guides whose knowledge of art is outstanding, but who have such warm and friendly personalities that they simply want to share with you their knowledge of and enthusiasm and passion for art. And I promise you that at the end of the 2 hours, you will leave knowing that you've experienced something exhilarating, uplifting, unique, and unforgettable. In the meantime, I'd just like to whet your appetite for the London Walks National Gallery tour by talking about a couple of paintings that I'm particularly fond of, both by British artists. The first is called The Graham Children by William Hogarth, and it was completed 1742. It shows the four children of Dr. Daniel Graham and his wife, Mary. Dr. Daniel Graham was a very successful and wealthy apothecary, dispenser of medicines, to the royal family and the Royal Hospital at Chelsea. And he and his family lived in a grand mansion, 11 Pall Mall, very fashionable district of London, just a short walk from the National Gallery, where the painting now hangs. And the setting for this painting was almost certainly one of the rooms of that residence. Free from parental supervision, the children are engaged in a variety of activities. Moving from left to right, first of all, we have Thomas. He's one, he's the baby of the family, and people are often surprised to learn that he's a boy because he's wearing a dress. But in those days, boys weren't breeched, put into trousers, until they'd been potty trained. He's sitting in a children's go-kart, and he holds in one hand a broken rusk, a type of biscuit, and he's moving forward to grab with his other hand a pair of cherries that his elder sister is dangling in front of him. She's Henrietta Catherine. She's 9 years of age, and she's wearing a beautiful blue dress and a muslin apron, and part of the apron she's draped over her arm to form a beautiful S shape, what Hogarth described as being the serpentine line of beauty in his theory of art called the Analysis of Beauty. She's restraining Thomas with her other hand, probably trying to prevent him from tumbling out of the go-kart. Next we have Anna Marie. She's five. She's about to start a dance. She's lifted up the skirts of her dress and apron between the forefinger and thumb of both hands, revealing beneath the skirts of her dress a dainty pointed shoe. She's put her foot forward, about to take her first step. And then finally is her brother, Richard Robert. He's 7 years of age, and he's seated on a high back chair over which is draped lavishly a curtain that extends up beyond the picture frame. And this is very much in the grand manner of portraiture. When important people sat for their portraits, they'd often have as a backdrop a magnificent curtain. And this is suggesting his status in the family, heir to the family fortunes. And he's balanced on his knee a musical box. Carved on the side is Orpheus charming the animals with his music. And this is a reference to the purpose of the box. It was used to teach caged birds to sing. And above him is a goldfinch in its cage. So on the one level, this is a wonderful portrait of children engaged in playful activities. But in a painting by Hogarth, every detail matters. And he's chosen activities and props for his painting, which make reference not just to the personalities of the children, but also make comments upon the nature of childhood and indeed of life itself. One of the striking features of the picture is that the children are dressed like mini adults, particularly the three oldest ones. Look at the girls with their nipped in waists where the bodices have been tightly tied at the back. And Richard, well, with his waistcoat and breeches and stockings and fine buckled shoes, is dressing just as his dad would dress. And they're engaged, you might say, in activities which are aping the adults. So Henrietta's in charge of the children, Anna Marie's doing an adult dance, and Richard playing teacher to the bird in the cage. In the 18th century, childhood was shorter than today because life was shorter. Life expectancy was about 40, and 25% of the population lived to the age of 9. So life could indeed be brief. And this was all too well known to the Graham family, because tragically, Thomas, the baby, died before the work was completed. And Hogarth made changes to the picture to allude to that tragic fact. So by the child is a silver bowl, possibly designed by Paul de Lamoury, the finest silversmith of his age, known to Hogarth, laden with fruit and vine, traditionally a memento mori, a symbol of death. And the flowers scattered on the marble floor with their stalks crossed carnations are traditionally a funeral flower. On the handle of the go-cart is carved a gilded dove, appearing to be in flight, the departure of the spirit from the child. And the broken rusk, symbolic of the fact that death can catch us unawares. Most particularly above Thomas is a mantelpiece on which there's a clock showing the time 1:45, possibly the hour of Thomas's passing, and also referring to the fact that he died before he'd reached the age of 2. But there's also a figure holding an hourglass and scythe. That's Father Time. But in this case, instead of a grim reaper figure, we have the softer image of a cherub, in keeping with the sensitive nature of the child's death. So, the brevity of life, one theme. And there's another theme, and that's the loss of childhood innocence. The idea that these children are sheltered from the outside world at present. But as they enter adulthood, they will be exposed to the dangers of the world. They'll learn that things are not always what they appear to be, and that people don't always say what they mean. And that can be seen by contrasting the two youngest members of the family with the two oldest. If we start with Thomas, he's the baby, and he responds very physically to the world around him. So he says cherries, and he regards them as food, although, as we'll see, cherries can have different meanings. And Anna Marie, she's simply enjoying the pleasures of a dance. But when she's an adult, she'll learn that dancing's part of the ritual of courtship, and her cheeks may be flushed for reasons other than being out of breath. So they are still in the innocent bubble of childhood. And then we look at the older two, starting with Richard. He's playing the musical box. He's teaching the bird to sing. And the bird, the goldfinch in the cage, is twittering in response to his music. So Richard is happy and is laughing. Yet the bird is twittering, but it's not because of Richard's music. It has seen the cat behind the high-backed chair out of Richard's view, with its jaws juddering and its claws outstretched, staring longingly at the bird, waiting to pounce. So the bird is frightened, and that's why it's squawking. And the bird, if you like, symbolises the innocent child protected in its cage from the outside forces personified by the cat, which destroy innocence. It's also been suggested that the cat is the alter ego of Richard, and just as the cat preys on birds, so too will Richard, as an adult, prey on females. And if you compare the faces of the two, you may see similarities. Maybe that's going a bit too far. And then Henrietta, she's the only one of the four who looks at us directly, as though she's already starting to engage with the adult world. Now, cherries in art can be a symbol of the innocence of childhood, of the Virgin Mary, but there's also an English expression, to lose one's cherry, to lose one's virginity. Now, at the age of 9, Henrietta still has hers preserved, but that would only remain the case for another 10 years. For she married at the age of 19 her second cousin Daniel Malthus. She had 7 children and was apparently ever the doting and loving mother. And one of them, Thomas, became a clergyman and a writer. And she lived long enough to be presented with a copy of his Essay on the Principles of Population as it Affects the Future Improvement of Society. And the writer and historian Keith Thomas thought it ironic that she should be the mother of the gloomy economist T.R. Malthus, who would blame the world's miseries on an excess of children. So The Graham Children by William Hogarth. The second painting I'd like to talk about is called An Experiment on a Bird in the Air Pump by Joseph Wright of Derby, completed 1768. Joseph Wright was very proud of his birthplace and principal residence, Derby, a city in the Midlands, which was the centre of the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century. He was friends with scientists, known as natural philosophers in his day, entrepreneurs, inventors, and he shared with them a passion for science, and in particular, the idea that science, when applied to industry, could bring benefits to everyone. He was a successful portrait painter, but he is better known for a series of paintings which he called candlelight subjects, where in a darkened setting there'd be a principal light source which would create great dramatic effects with the contrast between light and shade, or to use the Italian term, chiaroscuro. And of all the paintings, arguably An Experiment on a Bird with the Air Pump is the finest. Now, the title gives a fairly accurate description as to what is going on in the painting. The setting is a room in a private residence where a family have invited a travelling lecturer to conduct an experiment for their education and entertainment. On the table in the centre of the room, the lecturer has set up his apparatus, which is an air pump, invented in Magdeburg, Germany in the 1650s and made popular in this country in the 18th century by Sir Robert Boyle. And it was used to demonstrate the principles of oxygen and the necessity of air for all living creatures. Attached to the air pump is a handle, and on top of the air pump is a glass container. And the lecturer standing behind the table, facing us, has turned the handle, which has sucked out the air from the glass container, and we witness the results, because within the glass container is a huge white bird, a cockatoo, possibly the pet cockatoo. Now, normally, a mouse or a tiny bird would have been used for this purpose, but for full dramatic effect, we have this huge, rather rare and precious bird. In front of the air pump is a candle, which is the single light source of the room. It's partly obscured by a glass container in front of it, which seems to contain the remains of a skull. And put together, the candle and the skull are traditional memento mori, symbols of the transience of life. Now, the candle beautifully illuminates the faces of the people gathered around the table looking at the experiment. And that's what Wright really wants us to focus on. Not so much the experiment as the reaction of the people to it. So if we go round clockwise, leaving the lecture till the end, our eyes are immediately drawn in towards the figures of the 2 young girls, beautifully illuminated by the candlelight. The older can't bear to look. She's shielding her eyes with her hand. And the younger, well, her face is a picture of distress. Neither are bothered about science. All they care about is the suffering of the bird. The man standing behind them is probably their father. And at first sight, he appears to be comforting them with his arm around the shoulder of the elder daughter. But his other hand is pointing up towards the experiment. So in actual fact, he's encouraging them, nay, urging them to look at the experiment, to look and to learn from it. Next to them, seated at the table, is an elderly man who's been identified as possibly Erasmus Darwin, a friend of the artist. He's adopting the traditional pose of a philosopher, with his elbows on the table and his chin resting on the fists of his hands. He's not looking at the experiment directly. He's probably seen it many times. And maybe he's contemplating the implications of science. In the right hands, it can be used to the benefit of many, but in the wrong hands, it can be used with disastrous consequences. Then there's a gap so we can have a better look at what's going on. Then we have a young man who's dispassionately regarding the experiment. And in fact, he may be assisting the lecturer by timing the experiment with his pocket watch. Next to him is a young boy, possibly a brother of the girl's, who's craning his neck to try and get a better look at what's going on. He's really excited by the experiment, not worried by it. And then finally, we have a young couple who seem to have no interest whatsoever in the experiment before them. They are staring lovingly into each other's eyes. All they care about is their love for each other. On the right-hand side, there is a young boy, possibly another member of the family, who is appearing to lower the cage for the pet cockatoo. He's uncertain. If the bird survives, it'll return to captivity. If it dies, the cage will no longer be required. And next to him is the window, outside of which we can see the full moon, which refers to the Lunar Society. Now, this was a group of intellectuals who would meet every month when there was a full moon. So at the end of their discussions, they could be guided home, quite literally, by the light of the moon. And although Wright wasn't known to be a member of this society, he certainly had friends who were. And then finally we turn to the lecturer, arguably the most dramatic character in this painting, with his wild-eyed expression, raised eyebrows, long silvery grey hair, loosely tied red robes, finger-pointing gesture. He appears almost like a magician, some might say like God, for indeed in the rare depictions of God in art, he's often shown as an elderly gentleman with long white hair. And you could say he's playing at being God in this scene, because he literally holds the fate of the bird in his hands. If he releases the valve at the top of the glass bowl, well, air will return and the bird will revive and live. If he leaves it too late, the bird will die. So ultimately, the decision is down to him. And yet, as he looks directly at us and gestures towards us, it's as though he's handing over the decision to us, as if he's saying, the bird can live or die. You choose. But of course, we can't choose. We didn't paint the picture. It's the artist who decides. And Joseph Wright of Derby has decided to leave us with a cliffhanger. We'll never know what happened to the bird. But we do know what happened to the lovers. These we can identify as being Mary Barlow and Thomas Coltman. They married a year after this picture was completed in 1769. And 2 years later, in 1771, Joseph Wright painted their portrait to celebrate that happy event. And by great good fortune, that portrait, Mr. and Mrs. Coltman, is also in the National Gallery, hanging not far away from Wright's great masterpiece, An Experiment on a Bird with the Air Pump. Well, I do hope you've enjoyed my commentaries on those two paintings, and thank you so much for listening. As I say, the National Gallery has reopened to the general public, but I do urge you, when London Walks are able to offer once again their National Gallery walk, I do urge you to take it. You will have a truly magical and unforgettable experience. So I wish you all the very best, and thank you again so much for listening. Goodbye.